Accession number 18613, Reel 2.
Ross Edwards, Reel 2.
Yeah, they have Korean festivals over at Kingston. And the Korean Veterans Association, we go over there, we do a parade for them, and it's mainly for tasting their food and this sort of thing. But it makes a very interesting afternoon over there in the Fairfield Green.
And what company and platoon and section of the 1st Royal Fusiliers were you in? Can you remember?
Oh, yes, I was in Baker Company. And it was on the boat going over that the company sergeant major, Dickie Richardson, came up to the company and he wanted to know if anybody could type. And that was when I got collared for being the company clerk. Once again, I turned around and said, I could. Two-fingered. He said, well, that's the best offer we've ever had. He said, we'll use your two fingers. So therefore, I was then the company clerk and I had to do some of the typing for the notice board, etc. But I was in the headquarter company of Baker Company. That was in the 1st Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers.
Now, you said you went into the line in a soft position, first of all. Can you describe what that was like?
Well, 159, Hill 159. That was the soft position. We had one tank buried in at the top of the hill, which used to fire two or three rounds on a daily basis. And our hooches, or where we lived, under the ground, were spread all round that hill. Headquarter part of the company was at the back, and then you had the three sections all round us. And, three platoons all round us in their different sections, etc. And one of the ammunition trucks that came up to furbish the tank with his rounds of ammunition, never forget, poor young chap, he turned the vehicle round, backed all the way up the hill, jumped out of the truck to go and get somebody to help him unload it, and forgot to put the brakes on. He went all the way back down the hill, turned over and spread the ammunition all over the place. And it was on that hill that we lost one of our chaps out on a recce patrol. He triggered off an anti-personnel mine, which went up through his thigh, and he died, loss of blood, etc., before they could get him back. So, yeah, it was a quiet position. We had a few shells thrown over at us, but not as bad as what some of the other people have had. But that was a quiet position.
What was your own job on Hill 159?
I didn't specifically have a job. I don't think anybody really specifically had a job. You had to stand to just before sunrise every morning, where everybody was on duty in the trenches. And also in the evening, everybody had to stand to into the trenches in case of attack or anything like that, because that generally comes at first light or last light. And the in between the periods of that, then spot of guards, you know, you had to keep your duties that more or less two on and four off sort of thing in a sort of particular part of the trench. There are no actual duties as such, at least I can't remember any, and it was a matter of keeping yourself clean and tidy, having a shave here and there and getting your food when you can, because you were on compo rations then, C rations as they class them, and you had to do your own cooking. You didn't have the camp cook or anything like that, so you were more or less looking after yourself all the time. And what with that and sleeping, there wasn't a great deal of time to do anything else, really, apart from reading and writing home, the normal chores of everyday life in the forces.
How did you do the cooking?
Oh, we had the little old chuffers. Little old chuffers. They were, you had a kerosene can on top of the bunker, on top of the hooch, with a lead running down from it. And you'd have an ammunition box at the bottom. And you'd have a little tap there where you, the fluid used to drip through and you used to light it. And that used to chug away all day long. And they used to put your food on, in the billy cans on top of that. And it used to warm up quite nicely. If you turned up the tap a little bit more, then you can heat it up a little bit quicker. And if you didn't want it, like during the summer months, then you could turn it right off. But they were just made out of the ammunition boxes.
Was it dangerous?
Oh, no, not dangerous. They'd been using it before we got there. So we just carried on using the same idea, because they'd had a static line for quite a while, and with a soldier's innovations, they'll always find one way of doing it, because the soldiers always march on their stomach, and they always have a cup of tea. So as long as they've got somewhere they can heat the water up, they're laughing. And yeah, this is how we used to do it.
Were there any accidents?
Not as far as I can remember. It's pretty safe. You got the kerosene, that's on top of the roof, so anyway, if anything happens, that was out of the way. But just a little feed down, I mean, it's sort of a drip feed, so to speak, like. And it just used to burn away merrily.
And the hooch was a bunker?
Well, a house under the ground, let's put it that way. You used to have a pretty solid roof over the top, and it used to be dug out of the ground. And then you used to have you had a couple of beds in them, piece of angle iron down either side with wires across to give you a sort of spring in the middle. It's put on four stakes in the ground, and it was there for be there for a long time. If you break a piece of wire, then all you do is renew a piece of wire and off you go again. You had a good old sleeping bag that you could climb into now and again, but of course when you're in the front line you don't really get undressed, not as undressed to get a bed. Keep majority of your clothes on, especially during winter. And you washed and shaved as best you could. I suppose we weren't as clean as what we could have been, but we kept ourselves pretty clean. Then every now and again you'd be taken back behind the lines for delousing or whatever, spraying with the old DDT and get a shower and that sort of thing, and then go back up the line. As I say, those days were very nice, but any other time, no, you've got to do the best you can. And I think, you know, by and large, a soldier is a pretty clean person, and they get a sort of, when they're off duty or going to be off of duty for a while, yeah, they'll get in there and have a bit of a wash and brush up and clean themselves up and get a clean pair of socks on, because that's the main thing. The old army boots are all right, and the all-weather boots that we had out there, but they did make your feet sweat a bit, so therefore it was nice to get a nice clean pair of socks on.
Did you get any vermin in the front line?
Oh, yes. I always remember this chap, I believe it was Saunders. I was laying there asleep one day, having a bit of a kit. We had a bit of a rough day. We had quite a few shelves over, and we'd been standing too off and on quite a bit that day. And I was down in the old bunk having a nice little kit, and this other chap, he just let off his Sten gun in the hooch there, and he got a couple of rats that were running along on a little shelf just underneath the top of the hooch there, and yeah, he killed them both. He told me that when I woke up. I didn't wake up. He fired the shots. I didn't hear him. So, yeah, at times you got rather tired. And I think, you know, it's one of those things where a soldier has to sleep when he can. And when he sleeps pretty soundly, I think.
But did you get bodily vermin?
Well, not that I know of. As far as I'm concerned, the only thing I ever came out with was a bit of the old foot rot. But you were taken behind the lines in D-Loust every so often. And of course, when you're behind the... You're only in the line for so long. Can't remember how long we used to spend in the line. But every now and again, they'd come up, collect a load of you, take you back behind the lines, and you used to be D-Loust, have a shower, then go back up. So if you can do that every 2 or 3 weeks, yeah, you can't be too bad. And as I say, the worst period, of course, was during winter, because it used to be so cold. You used to take, wear your underpants, and you never took those off, not even to go to the toilets. They were split front and rear, ready for you, because it was so cold. If you'd touched the seat of the toilet when you were going to the toilet, you could have been frozen to it. So you used to wear your long johns, then you used to have your combat trousers on, and now your fatigue trousers, then you'd have your army trousers, and then you put your combat trousers over the top. It's the same at the top. You used to have your shirt on, your vest on, and then a couple of jackets on top of that. Anything to keep warm. Because the temperature certainly dropped out there during the winter periods.
Were there any incidents with the enemy in this first position?
No, only the odd shelling and that sort of thing. The odd, as I say, the poor guy who got killed on the recce patrol. But apart from that, I don't think any of our patrols that we did send out, because you have to send out a sort of standing patrol at the end of the minefield. That used to be happening on a daily basis. And then the other patrols that used to go out, you used to have a fighting patrol or a snatch patrol or the ambush patrol. They used to go out over the top of the standing patrol and go off out into the field. But I don't think we had any real skirmishes, not in the first place, because the North Korean lines were quite a way away on that stretch. You could see them being bombed during the day with the napalm. The American Air Force had come over and napalmed their positions, but it was quite a way across that valley. As I say, it was really a cushy position. It's when you get closer to the enemy that, at one stage, when we were on the hook, they used to come and put signs, hang signs on our barbed wire at the bottom of the minefield. That was how close they were there. But the hook, of course, that had quite a few big battles going on there.
What do you mean by the standing patrol at the end of the minefield?
Well, you've always got a path down through your minefield. And the standing patrol used to just go out and sit down at the bottom of the minefield, about 4 or 5 men. They're a sort of early warning system, so to speak. But they would know of anybody around down that area. And then, of course, you've already got your guards, which are the other side of the minefield, who are also waiting for any signs of activity. But the first port of call, of course, is the standing patrol at the bottom of the hill, or the bottom of the minefield, as it used to be.
And so when they're finished, they're immediately replaced by somebody else?
No, well, they come back in before just before daylight, just before stand two. Stand to, that was when everybody is in the trenches just in case. It's the same as last light, you get everybody standing in the trenches then, and that is when the standing patrol will go out, and then any other patrols that go out after them.
So where did you go to after this first position?
I wish I could remember all the positions I've been to, but we did go up to 154, and we did up 227, and 355, and we did spend time on the hook. Well, the hook was the last position we were on over there. But the actual order of them, I'm afraid the old memory's a little bit hazy on that now. But as I say, I always remember that first position because that's where we lost our first man, and that's when we first started to be. That's when you grew up. That's when you knew what war was about. The fact is, it could kill anybody. And if you didn't die for cover when you heard those shells coming over, you could have been next.
Was the hook the worst position?
The hook would have been the worst position because that the North Koreans and the Chinese had, because the peace talks were going on, the North Koreans and Chinese had a big push, and they tried to take an American position. Well, they did take it, and the Americans fought back hard and regained it. And then they started on the hook, because if they could have taken the hook, then the whole of the brigade would have had to drop back. It gave such a commanding view over the valley behind that the brigade would have had to drop back quite a way. Consequently, where you've got the demilitarised zone now, it wouldn't have been. It would have been a lot further back. And Duke of Wellington's, I believe, were on that hill and took the last big fight. Now, that was just before the coronation. Coronation was June 53. So that would have been in May 53. There was a big fight on then for that hill. And in actual fact, we were in reserve at the time, and they mobilised us and put us up in readiness to go back in and to help. I'm sure it was the Duke of Wellington's, we were on that hill then, and we were supposed to be ready to go back in. If they'd lost the hill, we would have had to have gone back to take it. But, we'd just been getting ready for all our celebrations for the coronation. And a call came through about 6 o'clock at night. And about 7:30, 8 o'clock, we were heading up to the front line, all geared up, battled up, ready for going back in to retake the hill if necessary, retake the hook, because I don't think the brigade would have allowed it to fall into enemy hands, no matter who was brought in for that fight. There's a big passage in the book that I was reading on that, the Korean War, and it was a very interesting reading. And yet we didn't have to go in and take that hill because they held on to it. And then we came back down to our rest position, but unfortunately by then the coronation festivities, as we were going to have, had to go by the board. We were just about worn out and ready for bed then. So we just had a good old kip, and then we went back up the line. We went into the hook and relieved the, I'm sure it was the Duke of Wellington's, and relieved them for all that position, and that's where we finished up on the hook for the last 2 years, 2 months of our service over there.
What was it like in the hook?
Same as anywhere else, but because we were so close to the enemy there, that you used to have more contact with the patrols. Luckily, I was one of those that was very lucky and didn't get on one of those patrols, which had a skirmish. I used to do quite a bit of the standing patrols just down the bottom of the minefield, which is the one that everybody liked. And it was just a matter of living underground like we've been doing all the time. There was one part of the hook where one of the platoons were, which is very, very close to the enemy. And they used to come out and hang these signs up, like "Go home" and "This is not your war, why are you here?" and this sort of thing.
Were these pieces of paper?
No, generally on rag. Generally on rags, and just sort of hooked onto the barbed wire at the far end of what you class as the minefield. So you knew they were around, and yet you've got your standing patrol down there, so you do know how stealthily people did move. And there was one patrol that went out, and one of our poor chaps, he never did come back. And then, as far as I know, a chap by the name of Williams, I don't think they ever found out what happened to him. Just one of those things. Some of the patrols, I think you'll find, they were sort of infiltrated as they were marching along. Now, that to me takes a lot of believing, but it has been done. So I would say that the Koreans or the Chinese are very, very stealthy people. But there again, this is war, and you try and do anything once, and if you get away with it, good luck. And yeah, they did infiltrate a couple of our patrols, which caused it, you know, a little bit of havoc with them. One of our patrols from D Company was completely wiped out. A few of them guys were taken prisoner, and the chappie on the wireless operator, he got the MM, the military medal. He kept up a running commentary on the fighting that was going on. All the time it was going on, they'd taken a bit of a high hill, and they were completely outnumbered. And slowly but surely the whole patrol got wiped out. There were two or three prisoners taken, I believe, is that. But
was that on the book?
No, I can't remember exactly where that patrol was. As I say, it's funny, but the old memory gets a little bit hazy. But it was a couple of years ago now.
What effect, if any, did these slogans have, these signs that were hung up by the enemy?
Nothing, really. It was just treated as a laugh and a joke. Unless you're being beaten, I don't think any slogans or anything they throw at you or anything like that can really upset you. We weren't there for... You can't imagine a soldier just packing up and going over onto their side, or just packing up and saying he's going home. Nobody would allow it. So, no, they were just treated as a joke. They were. I don't know whether the North Koreans thought they'd have any influence, but I suppose you could say it's a light-hearted part of war. And you get quite a few of those sort of instances.
Such as?
Yeah, that was an interesting part. I shouldn't have said that, should I? Well, as I say, you get the... we used to go to Tokyo on rest and recuperation. And they got a nice transit camp over there, and you used to go down, you could go on these dirty great big American transporter planes. They used to take about 400 or 500 of you, and you used to go over to Tokyo for about 5 days. Very nice. And in this transit camp, where they take you to, that's your base camp, that's where they pick you up from the when they come back. But for the next 5 days, you've got... You're completely ad-lib to do exactly as you please. And you've got your bed in this transit camp, and do you know what? There's hardly anybody sleeps in them. They're all out round the bars and all the rest of it. Or they went down to Hiroshima and went to see different parts of Tokyo. Japan, and because it's a very, very interesting place. And even then, the traffic over there, I think, was worse than whatever the traffic was up in London at that time. So what their traffic's like now in Tokyo, I certainly wouldn't like to say. But they certainly, they had more cars on the road then than whatever they did in London. Now you go back to 52, 53 and think of what London was like, and then think of it now, and then think of what Tokyo must be like. I think they've got a better metro system than what we have in London, but they certainly needed it because there was millions of them on the road. And all they were doing was sounding their horn all the time, so practically all you could hear was a horn blowing all the time. It's amazing. But they were the better parts. We used to go over there twice, twice in 12 months. And there was a little place south of Korea, Incheon, was a nice little place. They used to send you down there for 3 days rest and recuperation. And that was quite a nice little place. There was a nappy place down there, and next door to a sort of transit type camp. And you could spend 3 days just wandering around down there. It's quite nice. And you get to know the local people and that sort of thing down there. And it made the silence down there compared with when you're in the line is amazing. Because there was no cars down there. It was all more or less horse and cart. Or the chaps would be going along carrying these dirty great big loads on their back on the A-frame. And whereas I doubt whether I'd be able to lift one of them. But they used to put them on the A-frame, go round in front of it, attach it across their chest, stand up and just walk off with it. I know they've been doing it for years, but the amount they used to get on there is amazing.
Did the noise in the front line have a bad effect on the troops?
No, I think there's quite a few of them that are deaf now because of it. As I say, I've had my ears tested and I was tone deaf. But in that first position on that 159R, stand two position was right next door to the tank that was dug in there, and he just used to let off his three rounds of ammunition or four rounds of ammunition at periodic intervals, and it always used to be, or seemed to be, when we used to be in the trench next door to him. So yeah, that messed up my ears, and I think there's quite a few of them have put in claims for deafness or tone deafness or what.
What was morale like when you were in the front line?
The morale through the troops was always tip-top. They always had a laugh and a joke for each other. They'd always help each other out. And you'd pop round to each other's hooch and have a cup of tea or a beer. In general, everybody knew everybody else because, yeah, you were in such confined areas. And it was more or less done on a friendly sort of basis. I mean, this is where your comradeship comes in. Unless somebody's been in the forces, I don't really...